If you were with us last weekend, you know, last weekend we began this brand new series together. And this whole series revolves around something that the Apostle Peter says in one of his letters. He talks to all of us, and he's not singling out any one person. Instead, he's talking to all of us as followers of Jesus. And he says this. He says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you for the reason or an explanation of the hope that you personally have. Now, one of the reasons why I love this verse so much is because Peter doesn't say, you know, always be prepared to give an answer for every question or explain every Bible verse that somebody points to. He's not saying that. He doesn't say be prepared to give an answer for why there's so many weird Christians in the world who kind of do weird things all the time, right? He doesn't say any of that. And he doesn't say always be prepared to explain why bad things happen to good people, right? That's not at all what Peter is talking about. And like we said last week, there are lots of places to get answers to all those kinds of questions. And there are tons and tons of questions out there. But what Peter is talking specifically about right here is he's saying to each of us, I want you personally to be able to articulate in a simple way why your hope is in Jesus. Peter knows that it's often difficult for us to explain this or to talk about this because our relationship with Jesus is intensely personal, and that can make it seem awkward and difficult at times to talk about. And he knows that there are lots of questions in this world that we're not going to have answers to. In fact, I would even tell you, I think there's many things in this world, many questions that we experience in life in this world that do not have answers on this side of eternity. But in the first century, and to who Peter was talking to when he wrote this, everybody living, especially at that time, none of them anchored their hope to a personal experience or an anchored prayer or even a situation that they could look back on and see how God came through for them. As wonderful and as amazing as those things are when they happen, instead, everyone, especially in the first century, they anchored their hope to this word right here, the resurrection. Right? And so last week, I sent you home, if you were with us, I sent you home with a bit of an assignment to think about during this coming week, which is to answer the question, why is my hope in Jesus? And I said that I think for all of us, as you think about this, no matter how unique or how individual your own story might be or the circumstances of your story or your life, I think all of us somewhere, our answer needs to reflect this idea of the resurrection, because as followers of Jesus, no matter what our background has been, it really is the resurrection of Jesus that gives us hope. And then we also spent some time talking about how in our answer to this question, Peter really wants to make sure that we are gentle and respectful, right? He said this is critically important in those situations where we feel like we're maybe being poked at or even being, you know, kind of interrogated by someone, perhaps someone even who's close to us. He says, I don't want you to overreact. I don't want you to get defensive. And it can be easy to get defensive in those situations. I know for me, when that happens, what I have to do is I have to remember that many times the reason why they're questioning me is because they're hurting. And so actually, the more dismissive or the more hostile they are, the more gentle and respectful I need to be, because that's what actually allows that person that I'm talking to feel like they can go ahead and ask me the next question, which is how, right? Which is so important. How in the world do we know this idea of the resurrection is even true? And that's where we're going to pick up together today. Now, this week, what I want us to spend some time talking about is very specifically the subject of the Gospels. Because unlike every other world religion on the planet, as followers of Jesus, what we believe is not based on a teaching, and what we believe is not based on a philosophy. Instead, it's actually based on history, on actual historical events, and what we believe is based on eyewitness testimony. And as followers of Jesus, everything that we believe about Jesus is based on, and it's grounded in four books, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And what makes these books so important is that these books claim to contain the narratives, the miracles, and the events surrounding the person of Jesus of Nazareth, which means, and maybe this is a new thought for you, but the key to understanding everything in the Bible is actually found in these four books, in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now again, that might seem obvious to you, but it's most likely brand new to whoever it is that you're talking to about the reason for your hope, because one of the reasons that many people in our world do not believe in Jesus is because they do not understand the connection between these four books and the rest of this book right here. And so that's what we're going to spend a few moments talking about today. So with that, hold on, because here we go. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in fact reliable accounts of actual events that took place more than 2,000 years ago, then Jesus really did claim to be the Son of God, because that is what these books record. And Jesus substantiated his claim to be the Son of God by performing a variety of miracles that are all recorded in these four specific books, including his personal resurrection from the dead. And so if Jesus really is the Son of God, then what Jesus tells us about God and what Jesus tells us about the rest of this book right here, specifically the Old Testament, is also true. And so as followers of Jesus, everything that we believe about God, everything we believe about the Bible, everything we believe about the Old Testament, all of it actually hinges on the reliability of these four books. Now, knowing that, we need to talk about, I need to make two important distinctions before we kind of go forward with this. First, we need to always remember that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not four parts of one book. Instead, they are actually four separate books. And the people who wrote these books had no idea that hundreds of years after they wrote their individual books, that in history, people would come along and they would combine those four books into one great big book that's nice and easy to carry that we think of as the Bible. The second distinction that we have to make is that whenever we're talking about history or something that happened in history, the question that we ask is not what is the proof. The question we have to ask is what is the evidence? Because whenever you're dealing with something that happened in the past, you can't prove anything. The only thing that you can do is you can look at evidence. This is why a jury in a court of law will examine evidence and then they draw conclusions from that evidence, because you can only prove things that are observable and repeatable, and history is not observable, nor is history repeatable. And so when you're examining evidence and you're trying to come to a conclusion about that evidence, again, the question that you're asking yourself is, what's the most probable explanation for the evidence that we have? Not what is a possible explanation. And again, the reason why all this matters and the reason why this is so important to you is because it is absolutely amazing that we have more information about a poor Jewish carpenter by the name of Jesus than we do the emperors of Rome who lived and reigned during this exact same period of history, right? You got to think about this. Men who ruled over an empire of 2 million square miles, with 55 million inhabitants, an empire that reigned for 2,200 years, and yet we know more about a poor Jewish carpenter than we do the men who were the rulers of this empire? I mean, whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, you owe it to yourself to ask the question, like, why in the world do we have these books? Why do we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Where did they come from? Like, did they just appear? How did we get them? And how in the world did they survive for 2,000 years? What is the most probable explanation for their existence? Matthew, you might know this, Matthew was an apostle of Jesus. Matthew wrote as an eyewitness, and so in Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, Matthew tells us about things he saw Jesus do and things that he heard Jesus say, and Matthew spent a lot of time with Jesus. Again, he was considered one of Jesus' closest followers. John was also one of the 12, so John also writes as an eyewitness. Now, John, not only did he write about what he saw Jesus do, do and what he heard Jesus say, John was also one of Jesus' closest friends. And so that means that John, along with Peter and John's brother James, those were the three guys who actually spent the most time with Jesus. And John is the only one of the apostles who was with Jesus while Jesus was being crucified. Now, Mark wasn't an apostle. Mark was actually a friend of Peter's. He was, in fact, a student of Peter's. And in one of Peter's letters, Peter refers to Mark as his son. Now, Mark wasn't Peter's biological son, but this is a statement that Peter makes explaining his closeness, his relational closeness to Mark. And so everything that Mark tells us actually comes from the eyes and from the ears of Peter. And then lastly, and perhaps most unique, is Luke. And again, Luke isn't an apostle. Luke isn't even Jewish, actually, which is kind of interesting. Luke is a very educated first century Greek. He grew up as a physician, so he was a doctor, right? So Luke was actually trained in an academic setting on how to be inquisitive. He was trained as a logical investigator. And just like you and I today, as followers of Jesus, don't miss this, Luke became a follower of Jesus not because of what he experienced personally, but because of the testimony of other people who were eyewitnesses to what Jesus said and did. And it's in the opening line of his account of the life of Jesus that Luke says something that's historically so incredibly significant, and yet the truth is we read this and we just blow right by it because it just seems like such an ordinary word, and so we miss it, but I do not want us to miss this today. This is how Dr. Luke begins his account of the life of Jesus. He opens up by saying this. He says, many, right? I know this is so dramatic, isn't it? Many, right? This is why I don't want you to miss this, right? Now, how many is many, right? How many is many? Now, four, that doesn't seem like very many, does it? Now, 40, right, that would be many, but it all depends on what it is that you're talking about. Right? This is so incredibly important. Do not miss how Luke starts this. This is not how you start a fairy tale. This is not how you start a made-up story. This is certainly not how you begin a lie. He tells us many people have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Right? In other words, Luke's saying, come on, I'm not the first person to actually attempt to do this. Many people have attempted to do what I am doing right now. Now again, quick question. How many people do you think are going to undertake to draw up an account of your life or of my life, right? Chances are, not many. Not very many, probably, right? And that's what makes this so interesting, because the truth is, not many people undertook to draw up the account even of very rich and famous and powerful people in the first century, right? So when you look at other common famous people in the first century and you ask yourself the question, well, how many accounts do we have of the life of rich, powerful, famous people who lived in the first century? Tiberius Caesar, right, who was the Caesar who reigned during most of Jesus' lifetime, there isn't one. We don't even have one. What we know about Tiberius Caesar, all of it comes from bits and pieces of other accounts of the histories of other people, and historians just kind of piece together what we know about Tiberius Caesar. Pilate, who we've all heard of before, the truth is everything we know about Pilate actually comes from accounts of Jesus' crucifixion. Right, so Pilate doesn't even have any. Herod the Great, who you've heard of, right? Herod was a very, very famous ruler over Judea. Herod is the one who was responsible for rebuilding and enlarging the temple. He built most of the architecture in Judea during Jesus' day. And Herod at least has one. Right, he's got one account. Josephus actually records a lot of Herod's life for us. So there's at least one for Herod. But do you know how many detailed narrative accounts we have of the lives of ancient peasants or crucified criminals? Or what about famous rabbis from the first century? Do you know how many we have? None. Not a single one. We have some stories. We have some quotes that have been preserved. We have some legends that have been passed down through the ages. but not even one. There is nothing even close to what we find in Dr. Luke's presentation of the life of Jesus. And that alone should make us ask another question, like, why in the world did Luke bother? I mean, in the first century, life was difficult, even difficult for a doctor, right? I mean, food was expensive, water was scarce, everything was done by hand, there was no refrigeration, no automation. Like, why would you invest the time? Why would you invest the effort necessary to produce an account of a Galilean day laborer turned rabbi who was crucified by Rome and rejected by his own people? I mean, why in the world is the story even worth telling? And why in the world would so many people undertake the job of coming up with an account of that story as well? And see, the answer is actually rather simple. It's because something extraordinary happened. But not just extraordinary. No, something extraordinarily good happened. Something that had implications, not just for the people of that day and not just for the people of that area, but for the people of the future and for the people of the entire world. And Luke tells us something so important. Do not miss this. It all happened among us. Right? It all happened among us. In other words, it happened in our lifetime. It didn't happen among them, Luke says. No, it happened among us. He goes on, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first, right? In other words, from the very beginning, were the eyewitnesses and the servants of the word. Luke is telling us, listen, I did my own research. I didn't just trust what other people said. I actually went out, I did the work. I talked to the people. I didn't listen to a bunch of hearsay. I went out and I interviewed all the people and I did it myself. I did it from the very beginning. I went back as far as I could go to get firsthand account of everything that took place. See, this is why, and maybe you've never thought about this, but this is why Luke is the one who tells us about John the Baptist and his birth. This is the reason why Luke is the one who gives us the birth announcement of Jesus, because he went back as far as he could go and actually talk to the eyewitnesses and the first generation of people who experienced these accounts, because something extraordinary happened. And so I myself, Luke said, I carefully investigated all of it from the very beginning, and I, along with many other people, decided to write an orderly account for you so that you would actually know the reason for your hope, right? So Luke is telling us why, right? He's given us the answer to the question, Luke, why did you write your book? Well, this is why, so that you could know the reason for your hope, so you would have an orderly account of all of this. So Luke tells us his reason, but let me ask you this. Are there any other possible explanations for not only why Luke wrote his book, but also why Matthew, Mark, and John wrote theirs as well? Right? Because what's undeniable is that we have these four books, right? Four different books written by four different authors, all about the life of one person, right? That's undeniable. Nobody argues with that. But what are the other possible explanations for why these four books exist? Right, these are the kinds of things that maybe you've heard friends or coworkers, maybe even teachers at school, maybe even professors back when you went to college. These are the kinds of things that you've heard people like that say. These four books could be the result of, you know, collective fabrication, meaning that these four guys, they all got in a room someplace and they said, okay, now that Jesus is gone, right, it's up to us to keep the dream alive. Right? And so what they did is these four guys got together someplace and they said, what we need to do is we need to make up some stories. We need to make up some really big stories and pass those stories around. That way, people will keep following Jesus. And so John said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to tell a story about seeing Jesus heal a guy who was born blind. Right? And Mark was like, you know, that's pretty good. And Luke was like, well, I'm going to tell a story about Jesus walking across water one day. And Mark was like, I don't know, Luke, that's okay. It's not as good as John, so I'm not going to include that in my book. right? That basically what happened is these four guys, they all got together and they made all this stuff up, right? That's what collective fabrication means. Now, here's the part you should know. There is not a single scholar anywhere, Christian or otherwise, religious or non-religious, there is not a single scholar anywhere who believes that collective fabrication is the reason why we have these four books. They all reject this idea, right? But it is a possible explanation. The second explanation is that they could be the result of collective confusion, meaning that, you know, they all got in a room and they were trying to think back about their time with Jesus, and John was like, okay, you know, I'm pretty sure I remember Jesus healing a blind guy at some point. And Mark was like, yeah, you know, that sounds familiar. I think maybe Jesus did that. And Luke was like, yeah, I think I remember talking to someone who did that. And Matthew was like, you know, when we were out fishing that one night, wasn't it Jesus that came walking by the water that we saw? I think it looked like Jesus, don't you think? I mean, it was dark out. I mean, I think it was Jesus probably, right? In other words, these guys, they really believed all these things that they wrote, but they were kind of confused about the very specific details that they recorded. Now, again, the problem with this possibility is that it would mean that these four guys were actually all confused about the very same thing, right, which I guess is still possible, but it seems, at least to me, like it makes this possibility even more unlikely. The third is that these four Gospels, they could be the result of individual fabrication, meaning Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all went off by themselves someplace, and they each came up with their own accounts about Jesus, and John went off by himself, and he made up his account, and Mark went off by himself, and he made up his account, and so did Matthew, and so did Luke. Now, the problem with this idea is that even though it might be kind of satisfying for you to think about this if you have a hard time believing in the miraculous nature of the miracles that Jesus performed, you'd have to admit it's kind of miraculous that all four of these guys would come up with the same thing on their own, right? So that, again, doesn't make this, to me at least, look all that possible. The fourth possibility is the idea of individual confusion. Right, again, that on their own, these guys really did believe all these things that Jesus said, that they said Jesus did, and individually on their own, they all wrote it down, and it just so happened that they were all kind of individually confused about the same types of things, right? And I guess they all just got really lucky. They kind of thought they remembered the same basic stuff, even though they weren't all sure about the details. Now, these are four of the leading possibilities for why the Gospels exist, other than what Luke tells us at the beginning of his account. But again, what you need to know is that even though you may have heard friends or family members, maybe even teachers at school or at college, say things like this at some point in time, there is no one in the academic world, religious, non-religious, follower of Jesus, non-follower of Jesus, that actually believes these things are the reason for the existence of the gospel. Because the people in the academic world know that these views do not hold up under scrutiny. And the reason why is this. Do not miss this. See, if all we had was Matthew, then you could actually make any one of these arguments stick. Right? Same thing if you just had Mark. Or if you just had Luke, if you just had John, right, then you could make any one of these ideas stick. But the idea that four different people, right, two eyewitnesses, two people who interviewed eyewitnesses, that they could come up with a storyline that was so similar and yet at the same time different. See, none of these possibilities actually holds up against the standard of probable cause. And so nobody takes seriously, nobody in the academic world, in the scholarly world, takes seriously this idea that these are the reasons for the existence of the gospel. So consequently, if taken at face value, if we believe these books are really written by the people who they say they were written by, then the most probable standard, the most probable explanation for why these books exist is because what they talk about actually happened. Now, further evidence for that fact is this. that when you read the accounts of the life of Jesus, you find exactly what you would expect to find if someone were writing down four different accounts, if four people were writing four different accounts about the life of the same person. Now, this is, in fact, major evidence. If four different people were writing about the same event, there are certain characteristics about their stories that you would expect to find. You would expect to find different emphases in those four accounts, right? You would expect that four different people would place a slightly different emphasis on the variety of events that took place during the period of time that they're writing about. And you would expect that their details would vary a bit. One person is going to give a lot of time and a lot of attention to certain details. Somebody else might not include any parts of details about those events at all. But there would be a general agreement in the flow of the story from beginning to end. In other words, everybody should kind of start the story the same, and everybody should kind of end the story the same, and you would expect, if it really was a real event that happened, that all the people telling you about that event, as you listen to their stories, they would move in the same general flow from beginning to end. Because when multiple people tell a story, right, they all start and they all stop the same way, but how they get there tends to change. And finally, and most importantly, you would expect that there would be apparent contradictions in their stories. Why? Because of everything that we just talked about. Because of different emphasis, varying details, and different perspectives of the people who are telling the story. And when you read the four accounts that we have of the life of Jesus, this is exactly what you find. Now again, if all we had were two accounts, then this would be different. But we have four accounts of the life of one person written by four different people. And when we open up the Gospels and we look at the Gospels from an evidence standpoint, what we find are different emphases, some varying details, but the same flow of a general story of events, the same flow from beginning to end, and most importantly, some apparent contradictions. This is actually a big deal. If there were no apparent contradictions, that would suggest collusion. That would suggest that these four people all got in a room together and they tried to get their stories straight. The fact that we actually have some apparent contradictions from the people who were witnesses or eyewitnesses is actually evidence that there wasn't any kind of collusion or fabrication that was going on their behalf. At the same time, there's still such a remarkable flow, and the details and the emphases are so remarkably consistent, that is also evidence that they didn't just fabricate the whole thing or make it up either. It is exactly what you would expect to find if you had four different people sitting down and writing about the events of one person from four different perspectives. Now, this may sound very academic at some point, but the truth is, you experience this exact same thing anytime a major sporting event takes place, right? If you're a Lions fan, you're ready for this year. If you're a baseball fan, you've probably already experienced this year. Anytime there's a major sporting event and there is a critical call or a critical play that happens, this same experience takes place. If you talk to four different people, right, two who are at the game, two perhaps who are watching the game from home, and you get all four of those people to tell their story about what they saw, right, you're going to experience the exact same thing. All the stories are going to be a little bit different. They're going to have a little bit of a different emphases to the details. Some are going to give lots of detail about certain parts. Others are not going to say anything about those parts. But as the story unfolds about what they saw, there's going to be an agreement from beginning to end, and they're all going to kind of move in the same direction. And often, even in those stories, you still have some apparent contradictions because of vantage point. Who was there, who was watching it from at home, and you have a different perspective about what took place. Now, when that happens in sports, right, nobody calls anyone or accuses somebody of lying, do they? No. Everybody recognizes that it's the fact that you've got different people who are observing the same event from four different perspectives. And here's the point. In sports, these things take place within a couple of minutes, right? Maybe an hour. What do you think would happen if you tried to record 3 years of a person's life as you experienced their life with them? right? The more time that there is to record, the greater the possibility of variation in perspective and the differences of perspective that are going to end up developing, which again, is exactly what you would expect to find when we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If there were no apparent contradictions, if there is no variation, that should actually make us suspect. But there's more evidence that we should consider about these accounts as well and the people who wrote them. These men never became famous or rich for what they did. I mean, if these guys ended up being rock stars, like, and everybody in Rome wanted their autographs, okay, maybe we would have a reason to question the things that they said. But these men, as well as the other disciples who followed Jesus, they actually spent the rest of their lives preaching and teaching a message that was considered to be illegal, right? They ended up being persecuted and tortured for what they believed and for what they thought. Peter and Andrew, maybe you know this, they were crucified. Matthew was burned at the stake. John was boiled in oil and then left to die on the island of Patmos. John's brother James was actually killed by King Herod. The other James was stoned by a group of Pharisees. Thomas and Jude were both martyred while they were preaching. Thomas in India and Jude in Beirut. Right? These men did not gain anything from the books that they wrote. In fact, their lives were actually made more difficult by the things that they said. Perhaps most significant of all is this. These men did not die for what they believed. In our world, we hear of people dying for their belief all the time. That doesn't mean anything. That does not make something true. No, these men, they didn't die for what they believed. These men died because of what they saw. And that is a big, big difference. When you read their books, right, their message was not, hey, Jesus taught some good things, or Jesus healed me, right? Jesus didn't answer all my prayers. That was not their message. Their message was, Jesus is risen from the dead. I saw him. Jesus is risen from the dead. I saw him. At the center of their message was not a philosophy. It was not a teaching. It wasn't the secrets of a better or happier life. It wasn't any of those things. At the center of their message was an event in history. And they went to their graves saying, I believe Jesus is the Son of God because I saw Jesus risen from the dead. And I'm telling you, that makes their message and that makes their writings and the events that they recorded for us significant. And that gives them a level of reliability and credibility that cannot be missed. Because, and you know this, a person may lie in order to save their life, but a person is not going to lie in order to die. And so why in the world did not only these men, but also countless other men and women who also witnessed and testified to these very same events, why did these four men recorded, why in the world did they all give up their lives for what they saw? Not because of a new way of life, not because of a new philosophy of life, not because of a new teaching, right? Not because of any of that. Simply because they saw Jesus risen from the dead. I'm telling you, that is overwhelming evidence that what these four books record is true. Now, maybe you're sitting there or you're watching at home right now and you're thinking to yourself, okay, Joe, you make it sound so simple, you make it sound so obvious. If that's really true, if it is, if what you say you is saying is really true, then why in the world did my history professor, my philosophy professor, my English professor, why did my teacher, why did all these people, why have they all said that these books are completely unreliable and you can't trust anything that you say that they say? And that's a great question, and you should ask that question. And the answer to that question is this, and I want to be careful how I say this. It is very easy for us as 21st century Christians, Americans, and especially as Western people, it is very easy for us to be biased against the supernatural. In other words, meaning this, before I look at this, before I read these accounts, I just want you to know I don't believe in the supernatural. Now, it's not that I don't believe in God, I just don't believe that God does supernatural things. I don't believe he multiplies loaves of bread and fish. I don't believe that he walks on water, right? I certainly don't believe that he came to earth as a human. And see, the reason I don't believe those things is because I've never seen them. and I've never experienced them. And since I've never seen the supernatural, and since I've never experienced the supernatural, then I don't believe in the supernatural. And because I don't believe in the supernatural, then I know that these events that these books contain cannot be true, and therefore these books cannot be reliable. Now, the irony about that is that's actually not a scientific or an academic basis on which to reject these four books. But it is the bias, and that is the basis. So therefore, the burden is placed on the academic community to come up with another possible explanation for the existence of these four books. Because again, what's undeniable is that we have them. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have them. You can't deny that. And you can't deny that they all point to the exact same thing. A man who said he was the Son of God, who died on the cross for our sin. And then as proof that he did, God raised him from the dead. So, if you can't dispute the existence of the books, then how in the world do you explain them? And how in the world do you explain them in such a way that you can get around the fact that they're filled with the supernatural? And so scholars and academics, they don't claim it was collusion, none of them. And they know better. They don't claim it was fabrication. They don't claim it was delusion. They don't even claim it was confusion. They don't claim any of those things. Instead, they have come up with the only other plausible possibility for why these books exist, and I'll tell you what it is. Matthew didn't write Matthew, and Mark didn't write Mark. We don't know who in the world Luke was, and John didn't write John. See, what they propose is that many, many, many years after Jesus died, after all the eyewitnesses were dead, there were still some people who believed in his cause, and so consequently, these rumors started, and over time, these rumors, they grew, and they grew, and they grew, and then many, 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 many years later, right, some random guy, we'll just call him Bob, right, because it could have been Bob. Like, we don't know, right? His name, it could have been Bob, so we're just going to call him Bob. So Bob, he says, you know what? I should write all this stuff down. And so Bob starts to write down all these myths and these legends and these stories about Jesus. And as he's doing that, he fills in some of the blanks here and there. But then he realizes, and he has this kind of light bulb moment, and he says, you know, if I call this the Gospel of Bob, nobody's going to believe any of it. So I know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to say it was written by Matthew because people will recognize that name. So Bob lies. But see, that's okay for Bob because the book is filled with lies, and the lies are actually there for what Bob thinks is a good reason, to substantiate what Bob thinks is the most important part of Jesus, the philosophy of Jesus. But see, in truth, Bob knows nobody actually cares about this. And so Bob adds to what Jesus said. And he adds all these fantastical stories and myths and legends to make the philosophy of Jesus more appealing. So is that possible? Sure. Anything's possible. The problem, however, is that for this theory to work, there can't just be a Bob. There also has to be a Sam and a Fred who do the exact same thing. Because we also have Mark. And we also have John. But do you know what the real fatal flaw of this whole theory is? It's actually all the manuscripts that we have for these four books. We have 2,100 manuscripts from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John just in ancient Greek alone. And they were not written 800 or 900 years after the events that they record, like the ones that we have that talk about Roman history. Like the ones that talk about Julius Caesar and Pompey and Herod the Great and Pilate. We actually have a recently discovered fragment of the Gospel of Mark that has been confirmed to date to 90 AD. Now think about that. We have copies of the book of Romans that date to 55 AD. And when you remember that Jesus died in 33 AD, that shrinks each of these numbers by 30 years. Right? This is absolutely amazing. We actually have parts of the Gospel of John that date to 135 AD, and these were found in Egypt. Now you got to ask yourself, like, what in the world is a copy of the Gospel of John doing in Egypt? In 135 AD, Right? That speaks to how widely distributed these books actually were in the first and second centuries. We have complete copies of all four Gospels, exactly like the ones that you have in your Bibles today, that date to 250 AD. Now, if our manuscripts came from like 900 AD and 1100 AD, like the ones that we have that talk about the history of Rome, then again, that would be a problem, because that would actually be evidence to support the theory of Bob. But the manuscripts that we have, all 2,100 of them, are far too young. They're too early. They point to the fact that Matthew wrote his gospel in 50 AD, that both Luke and Mark also wrote their gospels in 60 AD, all during the lifetime of many, many, many eyewitnesses. And so consequently, the many people in the academic community, they keep trying to push the dates of these manuscripts back farther and farther so they can try to keep their theory alive. But as time goes on and as discoveries are made and as archaeology confirms the dates of these discoveries, the evidence tells us, listen, it is not a theory that is alive. It is Jesus that is alive. And if you are one of the... If you are one of the many, many, many people in our world, especially college students, young adults, who have walked away from Jesus because of something, or the church, because of something somebody said about this book, or especially about the four Gospels, I'm telling you, you can come back. You do not have to check your brain. You do not have to give up your mind. You do not have to give up your intellect. It has nothing to do with figuring out why your professor in college was wrong. It has nothing to do with any of that. It has everything to do with the facts of why these four books were written. Because what we believe as followers of Jesus, listen, it's not based on a myth, it's not based on a fairy tale, it is based on a historical event, and history validates over and over and over again that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they are all reliable copies of actual events that took place and are documented by eyewitnesses. That's how we know, and that's why we can believe, regardless of what we see around us, regardless of the unanswered prayers that we all have, regardless of the suffering that we see in our world, regardless even of the questions that we just can't seem to get out of our minds and our hearts. The reason why we have hope, it is the resurrection of Jesus and the fact that he loved you so much that he died to pay the price for your sin. And then to prove that he did, God raised him from the dead. And we have to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of eyewitnesses to thank who testified to what happened, and specifically four men, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who wrote about what they saw, a dead man, Jesus of Nazareth, risen from the grave. Let me pray for you today. Heavenly Father, it is so miraculous to me. I still, every time I think about this, it just stops me in my tracks to think about what you've given us, to think about how you've preserved it. Jesus, to think about the fact that you didn't just give us one copy of your life, you gave us four by four totally different people. Jesus, it's so easy. It's so easy for us to get caught up in all the unanswered questions of life and miss the part that we actually have answers for. Why you came, who you are, and what you promised to do on our behalf. And so, Jesus, I ask in these next few moments that you would hear each of us as we personally and silently confess our sin to you.